history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories just waiting to be told if we'll take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in a place that you might not find on the map. You got to know how to get to Creston, California. And Tom Hidalgo certainly does. He is 97 years old. Lived here for about 10 years, but you grew up in another beautiful spot, Tom, Santa Barbara. What was Santa Barbara like on the California coast in the 1920s and 30s? Tell me about your childhood there.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my birthplace in Santa Barbara. I was born at 825 Canal Street. Later on, maybe a couple years, 1922, we had a visit from the King of Belgium, and he donated to Santa Barbara the first olive trees in Santa Barbara, and they planted them all along Canal Street. So Canal Street lost its name, and it became Olive, and it's Olive Street today.
I bet you stepped on a lot of olives growing up then.
Well, we used to try and pick them, but the city contracted with a fellow who pickled the olives. He contracted with the city and paid the city for the crop of olives along Olive Street. So we weren't allowed to pick the olives, even though they grew in our front yard.
Santa Barbara is a big tourist spot now. Obviously, people love the beaches, and they flock to the historic mission there that's hundreds of years old. How much of that mission was still intact when you were growing up?
Very much like it is, because during the earthquake, I think it was 1925 or somewhere around that area, they rebuilt the mission because most of it came down during the earthquake.
So you were a little kid when that earthquake happened?
Yes. At that time, I lived on the opposite side of town. I lived on the west side of town on Mitchelterranea and Almond Avenue.
So what do you remember about the earthquake? Did you feel it?
I remember we lived in a two-story house running out onto Almond Avenue along with everybody else in the neighborhood. Everybody came out of their houses, out on the streets. Most of the town or the older buildings, like where the Fox Arlington Theater is now, there used to be the Arlington Hotel.
So there was some significant damage in Santa Barbara from that quake.
A lot of damage in Santa Barbara. There was a lot of reconstruction went on there. It led to what it is today.
And what about you as a kid? What were the things that you spent your time doing? Did you have to work from a pretty young age? Were you out playing around, or what were you doing?
Being Hispanic, my father taught us that we should learn Spanish at home. He said, English, you're going to learn at the school. I went to school with a fellow, his last name was Hatlin. He was from Denmark, and we started Wilson Kindergarten together. He didn't know any English. I didn't know any English, and so the teacher in kindergarten put us together. How we got along, I don't know, but we managed to play together, and we stayed in high school. He died about 2 years ago. All through grammar school, we separated. I went to Harding. He stayed at Wilson. Then we went to Lacumba Junior High, and we met up again, and then we went all through high school together.
And you stayed friends all these years?
Yes, we were friends all those years.
I know it's a long time ago, but you seem like you have a pretty sharp memory. So do you remember what your dreams or ambitions were? What you thought, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to be or I'm going to do?
I like music. I guess most Hispanics do. So I took up being a musician. I started out by learning how to play the violin, and then later on, when we grew up a little older and the big-name bands came on the scene, I took up the tenor sax and the clarinet. I used to play at one of the local spots. Well, there were two places. One was the El Paseo. That was quite a restaurant in there, and I played there. I also played out at Cantina or Beer Gardens. We used to play on Sunday afternoons at these beer garden places. I even got to play down as far as Santa Paula and Ventura.
Was there a signature song you liked to play or that you were the best at?
Oh, no, we just played whatever the big name bands played. We tried to imitate them.
And I understand music was a part of your military journey, but before you got in the military, you met a special someone who was going to be a part of your life for more than 7 decades. What? Tell me about how you met your late wife, Jenny.
I was from the La Cumbre, the North Junior High in town, and she was going to Santa Barbara Junior High. I was starting high school, she was starting junior high, and we met at a track meet between the two schools. Cousin of mine introduced me to her, and we just hit it off from that day on. I took time out from the service, came home, and married her before I got shipped overseas.
Well, let's talk about how you ended up in the service. Did you go in before Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was in 1941. I joined the National Guard because we used to get paid a dollar a drill, and a dollar was went a long ways at that time. Every Monday, would go to National Guard drill, and you'd get paid every 3 months. And it got federalized. We were artillery, so we got sent up to Fort Lewis.
Fort Lewis, Washington. So is that where you were on December 7th? What do you remember about that day?
I was in the band at that time. We were reading the Post Intelliger newspaper that was from Seattle. We were laying around on the bunks when they interrupted the program to tell us that Pearl Harbor was being bombed. Of course, immediately the call to arms was sounded throughout the 41st Cantonment, which was the area north Fort Lewis at that time. We were all called to draw our arms and get prepared. That afternoon, we moved our artillery pieces down to Grace Harbor, take the position of coast artillery because we didn't know whether the Japanese were going to come into Seattle or not.
And that sounds crazy to people now because they don't, you know, they've never heard of the Japanese coming to the Pacific Northwest. But at the time, for you, that must have been a real threat and probably pretty hair-raising to imagine.
Lately, I've read where there was a couple Japanese planes that were finally discovered there where they had flown into parts of Alaska there. We didn't hear about that going on until much later, when they went into Dutch Harbor, I think it was, one of those places up there. And then part of the troops in Fort Lewis were sent up to Alaska.
And I wonder if you heard about at the time, something I'm sure you know about now, but one of the places where the Japanese actually did come to the West Coast was your hometown. They had a sub that fired a shell right toward Santa Barbara there.
Oh, yes, out at Elwood. Of course, I wasn't in Santa Barbara at that time, but I remember reading about it. My wife sent me clippings of the paper. They had talked about the shelling of some of the oil derricks out there at Elwood.
And so here, you know, you joined the National Guard for a dollar a drill, and now you're playing your saxophone for the Army, but now you're at war. Was that hard to get used to or hard to swallow? How did that change things for you?
Well, I felt that I could do a better job of fighting the enemy with a weapon instead of a saxophone and a clarinet. Although we played for a lot of parades and bond rallies and launching of ships up along the Sound there. So I transferred from the band, the 144th Artillery Band, which is the 980th Field Artillery, a Long Tom outfit.
I'm thinking most people listening have probably never heard a Long Tom go off. Can you explain to us what that gun is like when you're next to it and it's firing?
Well, it has quite a sharp report to it. It's separate loading ammunition. Ram in the projectile, depending on the range. You put in so many bags of powder behind that projectile, and then you close the breech, and it's fired by a little shell. It ignites the big powder bag, which causes the explosion and propels the projectile out. It had a range of approximately 10 miles.
That's a long way, and it's also a pretty big projectile. How big were those things?
The projectile weighs 95 pounds. We didn't call it by pounds. Each projectile has little squares on it, and four squares is the maximum weight of the projectile. And of course, you're selective as to what projectile you put in to put the appropriate charge to propel it a set distance.
And how is that on your ears? Did you have some protection for your ears?
A lot of people used ear suppressants to dull the impulse, because after that projectile, it's kind of like a vacuum, and then the air rushes back in again. So it's kind of hard on your ears, but you get used to it after a while. I worked in the computation of setting the elevation and the deflection. Deflection is east and west, or for direction, and the other one is for altitude of the depression or the elevation of the tube to launch it, you know, like lobbing a football.
So
you have to get it to spiral like you do a football in order to keep it in its trajectory.
Are you saying you were working on the gun to set those, or you were giving them the settings to apply to the guns?
I was giving them the setting, computing, using a slide rule and firing tables to know what elevation and what deflection.
So that's a lot of responsibility. You're the one that's basically telling them, if you set these settings at these spots, you're going to hit the target. But whether or not you're right or wrong has a lot to do with whether people live or die.
Well, my job was as an operations sergeant during the war. I took the information off the map, put it on my slide rule, and through manipulation there, you came out with the firing data to put on the guns to get it to shoot where you wanted it to.
How many people do you think right now who are listening to this know what a slide rule is, or have ever seen one?
Well, there's a lot of people. There was a lot of artillery and different calibers. Because even the tanks had an artillery piece on them.
So you're doing all this in training. You're probably figuring that at some point you're going to have to go overseas, right?
Yes, we had quite a bit of training, and then we joined Patton's group out on the desert, out at Granite Mountain, out on the desert. Of course, some big open spaces there. We could really get to shoot 10, 15 miles, you know. So we got a lot of good training before we went overseas.
And I've heard stories about the Mojave Desert and that training with Patton's guys. In fact, my grandfather was there. I've heard that those tanks ground up the sand pretty fine and then it would blow. Did you experience any of those sandstorms out there?
Yeah, there were quite a few sandstorms out there at the time. Of course, today we have Fort Irwin out there, which is heaven now to what it used to be.
Well, you want to give us a taste of that? What was it like back then? What did you experience there?
You had one canteen of water, and you had to make it last all day. I had a lot of people from the East Coast that were in our battalion. I taught them a little trick about picking up a little stone and putting it in your mouth to keep the saliva going. That kept you from having to drink all that water all at one time and then going thirsty.
I'm sure there are people that are listening to that right now, and that'll probably come in handy for them sometime. But who taught you that trick?
I think I got it from my grandpa. My grandpa was part Indian. That went along with their boyhood. The Indians knew that. They learned to live that way.
What tribe was he from?
I don't really know. He must have been Apache or something like that, because he traveled across the border. Sometimes they were living in the United States, sometimes they were over in Mexico. The only people that I know that were doing that were the Apaches. That came about because you go to Fort Sill, and that's where Geronimo was kept captive.
And you decided, and I'm interested in how this thinking worked for you, because you told us about meeting Jenny when she's in junior high. And some guys, when they were about to go overseas, they were a little afraid to get married because they weren't sure they were coming back. What made you decide that, hey, it's time to do this now?
Well, she was the one that wanted to get married. And while I was at Fort Sill, I got leave, came home, and got married in Santa Barbara, and took her with me. At that time, I was stationed. It's a big artillery range now back in the southeast part of Washington, Yakima. Down below there was an Indian reservation, a little place called Toppenish.
So you took her with you to Yakima?
Yes. And when I was still in the band, by the way, and I used to play the dances at the Donley Hotel there in Yakima. And there was a fellow that played the accordion, Tommy Myers, I think was his name. I lived in Yakima.
And when did you guys get married?
42.
And then when did you go overseas?
Right after that. I went to Fort Leonard Wood. From Fort Leonard Wood, we went to Camp Miles Standish in Massachusetts. And from there, we went to ship to England.
Well, I bring it up just because I'm curious. Most of us have never been in a situation like that. But here you are, you're a young guy, you've got this new bride, and now you're heading overseas. Did you really think that you were going to come back?
I had something to come back to. Well, we had a lot of close calls and all that, but I guess the Lord was with me, and here I am. Because a few years later, I went to Korea.
Well, and you were also involved in one of the biggest military operations of all time, and certainly a day that I'm sure you can't forget, that everybody talks about, the longest day, June 6th of 44. But what about the build-up to that? I'm sure you were in England for a while getting ready for that.
Yes, we went there and calibrated our brand-new weapons that we got, because we didn't take the ones we had in the States. There were some already pre-positioned in England. So when we got to England, we trained with the Canadians and the British forces. We went to their artillery range, which is called Lark Hill.
And did you have any idea what was about to happen or what they were building towards?
Well, we knew that if we were going to go into Europe itself, France and Belgium and those countries, that we were going to have to. And we had several feints. We boarded ships and took a cruise looking like we were going to go, but it was further down along the Atlantic coast, never at Cherbourg.
But did you know that those were feints, that those were practices or false alarms, or did you think it was the real deal?
We thought that were the real thing. Nobody knew that. Well, somebody had to know.
Yeah.
Because we just went out there, Germans send their submarines out. Yeah, we lost a couple ships, and we lost some people, but nobody ever mentioned that.
Did you see that happen? You saw ships go down?
Well, no, I didn't. Generally, while we were on board the ship, we kept training people, because you never knew. You have to train two or three deep, because you never know when you're going to lose somebody, and then you can't operate because you're missing one cog, you know,
sure.
So you have to have spares.
Well, I know some people have probably heard about Operation Tiger and Slapton Sands, where there was a big practice invasion and the Germans showed up and picked a bunch of people off. And that was a disaster. And what you're talking about, you guys go out there and you don't even know that it's not the real deal yet, but you do know your life's in danger and there are German submarines in the area. How frightening or nerve-wracking was that?
You didn't have time to think about what you thought was, I'm here to do a job, and I've got to do the best I can. I never thought about I'm not going to make it. I always thought I'm going to make it.
And he did, and maybe that's part of why he did. Time for our first break, but we have much more to come with 97-year-old Tom Hidalgo of Creston, California. The invasion of Normandy, the Battle of the Bulge, and the big surprise he had waiting for him when he came home from the war. Check out photos and a short video of Tom at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 97-year-old retired Army Colonel Tom Hidalgo of Creston, California, originally from Santa Barbara, where he experienced the infamous 1925 earthquake. Tom would be involved in some of World War II's most famous battles, serving with the 980th Field Artillery Battalion, and that includes the invasion of Normandy. Tom came ashore on Utah Beach just a couple of days after the first troops stormed those beaches.
I wasn't on the initial wave. One of our units was on the initial wave. Where the infantry have companies in the artillery, we have batteries. Our B battery went ashore on D-Day. We came in right after D-Day. We were still getting shore fire. Not as dense as it was for the initial waves, but there was still a lot of people being killed.
Well, and I've got a couple questions on that. First, what happened to that B battery that went in on June 6th?
They made it ashore. There were some people that got shot up, but like in every other unit, if your unit went ashore on D-Day and you didn't get shot up, you were lucky.
So when did you go in, and what did you see as you were coming in?
We went ashore about the second or third day. We were loaded on some, like a raft made out of steel, and they had like little plows, and they would take you and load so many people on because there were many obstacles, and you had to clear those obstacles. Otherwise, you'd get hung up on them, and you were a sitting target out there. So they push you with these little plows, like, and you floated right over those obstacles, or they'd push you where there were no obstacles, but everybody was trying to get where there were no obstacles, you know, and sure, you couldn't all go there. So you tried to float over those obstacles, and the minute that barge hit the sand or hit one of those underwater obstacles, you jumped off and waded ashore or swam ashore, or somehow you had to get ashore, because you had to get to that sandbag up there to use it to keep from getting shot.
Tell me about your personal experience. Did you have to jump into the water and wade in?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, just coming off the ship, one of the cables that was had anchored off, somebody unsnapped it beforehand, and it was dangling back and forth and hit me on this arm. I thought I wasn't going to make it ashore, but I had help, and I got ashore.
And how much were you carrying? What were you loaded down with?
You had your own personal gear, your rifle, and enough ammunition to sustain you for a while. You knew that once you got ashore, you were going to get resupply from what was already on shore.
So I just want to understand the scene here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's artillery going off. There's probably machine gun fire. You've got a bunch of other ships in the area, and you're getting off this raft or barge into the water. You get hit by that cable. You're not sure if you're going to drown or not. And then you're trying to figure out how to get onto terra firma. That had to be a pretty chaotic scenario.
Well, we had leaders, and you follow those leaders. They generally had some type of a colored bandana or something, something that you could see. You could visualize and see them, but you follow those guys. Everybody had a group that they followed. It wasn't just a helter-skelter deal. It was everybody knew what he had to do and how he had to do it. We had practiced that before, and so it wasn't something new. It was just follow the leader, you know.
But I'm sure as you keep your eyes on the leader and you're trying to follow him, you're seeing...
What happened to that leader, then you had second thoughts. So who do I follow now?
Can you help us understand that scene? What else is going on around you?
They had beachmaster. Once you got ashore, then you followed whatever the beachmaster told you. That's where you went. He knew who was coming ashore, when they were coming ashore. It was pretty well organized. And if there was any errors, it's because you didn't follow instructions.
But I'm just imagining that as you come ashore and you're following the leader, you were probably also confronted with some of the things that had already happened there. There's probably death and destruction around you.
Well, there was a lot of dead people. Some of them were floating in the on the beach, and that's very demoralizing. So wherever we had a chance, we'd grab one of these dead bodies and drag it up and put it on the beach. Then they had trucks policing the beach and picking up all those dead and getting them on the ships back to England.
And I mean, I'm just imagining you couldn't have ever seen anything like that before, right?
No, you didn't visualize, saying that many casualties.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, how did you keep going and avoid...
Survival of the fittest, you know. You just, if you didn't want to join them, you better move.
So you were still getting shot at, or you heard fire?
Yes. Up until the time that you got behind that big sandbank, you were an open target. From all these obstacles they had stuck in the sand, barbed wire entanglements and all that, you had to cut them or go around them. It was much easier to cut them. But once you cut them, then it would whiplash back, and you don't know where it went after that. So there was something about cutting them that you hesitated to do that, because you cut it here and the tension would coil that thing up and it might strike through for other people down the road.
So there's hazards everywhere. And I'm sure throughout the rest of the war, there must have been some other close calls for you. But just coming ashore there at Normandy, what do you think was the closest something came to you there?
I don't know. I don't remember paying too much attention. So my thought was to survive and get ashore. And that was everybody's aim. Get ashore. Get behind that sandbank. You know, the tide comes in and washes off and it leaves a kind of a big bank, and that's where you wanted to be, because you were camouflaged there behind that and you had a good pile of dirt in front of you that those bullets weren't going to. And those Germans up there in those pillboxes, they were just shoveling it to you.
But it probably wouldn't be exaggerating to say that machine gun fire must have come within 50 or less feet of you?
Oh, yeah, there was, I don't remember, because I was self-preservation, you know, move in, never mind about the next guy. Somebody got shot ahead of you and you could help him, get him to cover. Well, you grabbed him and put him behind the sandbank, and the medics would come along and pick those people up. Some of those guys would probably be dead by the time the medics got to them, because there were so many of them. We went across the, right behind the sandbanks was a big lagoon, big marsh area. One little road going across that marsh, that led us into the town of St. Mary Gleese. After we went across that pond or that lagoon there, the colonel in charge of our unit said, just pull off the side of the road. We had already bypassed the German pillboxes, so we were behind them, so they weren't going to be shooting at us anymore. We were to cut down all the paratroopers that were caught in the trees. The Germans had shot them. They got tangled up in the trees, and the Germans shot them. You remember that story, that movie about that guy got caught up in the...
John Steele got hung up on the steeple of the church in St. Mary Gleese?
Yeah, well, a funny thing about it, I later on in life became a ham radio operator. I worked a fellow over in France. He was telling me about that guy, and I told him, you don't have to tell me about him. I was there. And I got a card from him after talking to him on my shortwave radio.
But so you and the other guys in your group had to go cut paratroopers, dead paratroopers down?
Cut down paratroopers. We spend a good portion of the day cutting down paratroopers because Colonel said that's very demoralizing to any subsequent troops, seeing all our people hanging in the trees because they got caught in the trees and the Germans shot them there.
Well, yeah, it would have been demoralizing for the troops coming in, and it couldn't have been easy for you to have that duty.
Well, when you're occupied and doing something, there's very few things that you think about, only survival.
So how long was it till your battery actually got set up where they could start firing those big guns?
Well, that same afternoon, we already had one unit ashore, which was our B battery. So they located us, and we married up with them, and now we had a battalion together. First of all, we had to cut off the peninsula. The Cherbourg sits way out here, and there's a big peninsula out there. So we cut off the peninsula, and then we headed north and went to Cherbourg and cleared that off. Then we came back and then got ready for around July, the St. Lo breakthrough.
And these are some of the major points of this invasion. I mean, the breakout at St. Lo was a huge thing. Just taking Cherbourg was big, too. But what were you doing personally during that time? Were you doing those computations?
Getting the maps and picking out the targets. Infantry units would call us where they got into a place where they couldn't break through with their fire, so they'd call us and tell us where it was at. We'd shoot it or blast it out of the way.
So you had to stay where the guns were, or did you have to go out in front of your artillery pieces?
No, we had forward observers who send their fire requests down to where I was in the fire control center. We took it from there.
So they're giving you this information. You're looking at a map, and you're doing the math to say, if we fire from point A at this angle, then we should hit the German forces that are there.
That's exactly what we were doing.
How did that work out? How accurate were your calculations?
Well, our maps were good, so we were only as good as the maps, because that's where we got our ranges from, and that's where we could plot where the enemy was and where we were. And knowing those two places, we didn't want to shoot ourselves, so we had to shoot at them.
Well, and yeah, and I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking, here you are, you're what, 24 years old, 23, 24?
Heck, I was 23 years old.
And here, I mean, you joined the military a couple years before, and you think you're going to play music in uniform, and that's your big job. But now you're in charge of not just one gun, but all these huge 13 giant artillery pieces that can kill a lot of people. The calculations that you...
So I'd do a lot of the calculations and then pass them on to some other guy who would send me to the guns. And then, meantime, I'm working on another one, get the firing data for that one to shoot.
Well, and I'm just thinking about this, and I'm thinking about our world today and the people who are listening. Some of them may like math, some of them may not. They've all had math tests that they've probably been anxious about, but you've got nonstop math tests, and the stakes are life and death.
Today, it's a different problem. Technology is such that where before we used firing tables and logarithms and all that's gone, you know. You don't have to worry about formulas or that anymore. Everything's in a little computer, and you press the keys and gives you the answers. You don't have to know the math. All you have to know is what keys to punch.
But you had to know the math, and if you were wrong, it could kill civilians or it could kill your own troops.
Well, yeah, if you came up with the wrong deal. But very seldom that you come up with the wrong deal.
But I imagine you felt the weight of that responsibility.
Oh, sure. I have a piece of paper, and I have a little book that I kept of all the places, all the different cities and the different towns that we set up at. Then we had to go to a little place called Sini, and we had to change all our tubes because they were worn out. You know, after you fire so many rounds through it, all the lens and grooves in there that give the twist to the projectile get worn out, and they no longer spiral like a football, you know.
You don't want to fire knuckleballs.
Yeah.
How long did you keep doing this? I mean, were you over there for the rest of the war?
I kept doing that till we got to Germany. Then I came home. The war was over about around May the 8th, about two or three days after the war was officially over. I was on my way home.
And I want to hear about that and seeing Jenny again and all that. But I'm thinking if you were there from Normandy through VE Day, there are probably a lot of other things that you were involved in. For instance, the Battle of the Bulge. Where were you during that time?
We headed off the Bulge. We raced around and put ourselves right where the enemy was coming. So then we helped slow down that advance because they were ready to break on through.
Well, and everyone who was involved in the Bulge, you know, they talk about the enemy, but they also talk about the weather. So what was your experience with that winter?
Well, the weather was very bad. You know, it was snowing, cold. We had recently, they had converted fuses. They took that from the anti-aircraft weapons. You know, they fire and the fuse is set, comes near a plane and it explodes. So they adopted that to the artillery. They fire the shell. When it comes near the ground up at a certain height, it explodes and it covers a big area, you know, with shell fragments flying all over. And they call those posit fuses. I remember just before the Bulge, we got those fuses. We had to go over to Holland to pick them up.
So that allowed you to fire anti-personnel shells, yeah. Basically?
Yeah. We broke up the fire direction center. We broke it up to two 12-hour shifts. For a two-week period, we'd handle the day shift. At the end of two-week period, we'd shift over to the night. The night crew would take over the day so that it wasn't a hardship on any one group. It was kind of alike by both groups. There were about 9 or 10 people in each one of those fire control groups. They were commanded by a major.
Tom wasn't a major yet, but eventually he would be. In fact, he finished his 35-year Army career as a colonel. But I have a few more questions about those days as a sergeant during World War II. When we come back, we're going to dig deeper into something that was starting right about this time all those years ago. December 16th, 1944 is when the Battle of the Bulge began. I know you can hear how young Tom sounds at age 97, but if you want to see what he looks like, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll bring you down the home stretch right after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Tom Hidalgo, 97 years old. And for the last 10 of those years, he's lived in Creston, California, a beautiful spot near what's turned into wine country around Paso Robles. Before we're done, we're going to hear about the experience that Tom had with Honor Flight Central Coast, California, a trip to Washington, D.C. But right now, let's go back to the most brutal winter on record in Europe and what you experienced during the Battle of the Bulge with that 980th Field Artillery Battalion. How cold did it get, and what was the worst thing you had to deal with that?
Well, it got pretty cold, but not as cold as Korea, but it was cold.
Well, we'll have to get to that, too.
I think we had better equipment in Europe than the old worn-out equipment and worn-out vehicles that we got in Korea.
So in Europe, during the Bulge, what did you have to keep you warm? What, I mean, did you have extra?
You had two blankets. And you had a sleeping bag. You had a good heavy overcoat. So you slept with everything you could. Overcoat and everything, you know, that was your nightgown.
I'm sure it never got that cold in Santa Barbara.
No, no, nothing like that. We never had snow.
And if you're on European soil for almost a year, I'm sure there are a lot of nights where you wish you could just go back to Santa Barbara and see Jenny again.
Oh, I was sure. Like I say, the war was over, and a couple of days later, I'm told the truck's coming by in the early in the morning, pick you up, you're going to Holland. From Holland, you're going to get shipped back to Cherbourg, and then you're going home. And I came home in a little minesweeper. But surprisingly enough, I met about three guys from Santa Barbara on that little minesweeper. Arthur Basham, Dwight Babcock, and Tony Orenia, I think it was. Three guys from Santa Barbara all on this one little minesweeper coming home.
Well, what are the odds? Well, tell me about the moment when you got to see your wife again after all that time and all those close calls.
I landed in New Jersey. Of course, we boarded the train and we got shipped over here to Marysville, or I think it's an Air Force base now, Camp Beale. And then I got separated there, put on a Greyhound bus and shipped home to Santa Barbara.
Was she waiting for you at the station?
No, because she didn't know I was coming in. Once we got off the ship, we weren't allowed to talk to anybody, tell them where we were going or how soon we were going. So she didn't know I was coming home. And when I got to Beale, we weren't allowed to use the telephones or call home. Or I got put on the Greyhound bus and landed to Santa Barbara early in the morning, called a taxi cab there, and he took me a roundabout way to increase my fare and took me home.
So what was her reaction when she saw you?
Well, everybody was surprised as all get out. You know, of course, I was probably more surprised because I came home and the wife now had a baby, had my oldest boy.
Had she written you letters about that? You knew she was expecting?
My aunt wrote to me on one of those V-mail or email one-sheet deal. She sent it to me while I was at, in England and told me that wife had a baby boy. So I knew about that. But the Red Cross didn't notify me till I was over in St. Mary Gleese there before they notified me.
Well, I want people to grasp this here, because you said, when I asked you about getting married before you went overseas, right? You said, well, that gave me something to come home for. But now I'm understanding for the first time here, the whole time that you're in combat, you're fighting with the awareness that you have a son that you're never going to meet unless you survive.
That's right. That's right. And then it seemed like the Army did all they could to keep me from seeing him till I got home.
What was that like, to lay eyes on your son?
By the time I got home about, say, 7 o'clock in the morning after the trip from Beale, my father had already gone to work when the taxi cab dropped me off in front of the house. They immediately called my father, and of course, he came home from work too. He was glad to see me home. I only had one brother, and he suffered from epilepsy, so yeah, he didn't have to go in the service.
Well, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but I have to imagine that all that time in Europe, there had to be at least a day or two where you wondered if you'd ever get to meet your son.
Oh, yes, constantly.
So to finally hold him in your arms.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed my stay because when I wasn't on duty, going through France and Paris, I stopped at the Selmer factory, picked me up a buffet clarinet. I brought that home, and my daughter lives in Reno. She has it now. So I misappropriated from the Selmer plant. And
spoils of war. You know, I didn't really ask you, but I'm sure they exist. If you were in Europe for that long in this field artillery battalion, you must have experienced some close calls that you can look back on now and say, boy, that's hard to believe I survived that.
I'd like to go back sometime. I just went back to Washington, D.C. on that Central Coast flight. I'd really like to go back and see that old church at St. Mary Gleese and see some Cherbourg. I'm too old, I guess, to go back now.
I don't think so. You're in great shape. But tell me this. Maybe it's not fun to think about or easy, but if you had to pick one moment from your time in combat that you would say was your closest call or the closest you came to not coming home, to not seeing your wife, to not meeting your son, what do you think that was?
Because of the compaction of the fighting going on there on the Cherbourg Peninsula, I think that was the closest infighting that we actually got to. After that, the St. Louis breakthrough, and we kept pushing the enemy, and they kept retreating, and we were pursuing them all the time. We were carrying the fight to them. They were carrying outside of the Bulge. That was the only deal where they actually started to penetrate.
And I realized that being in the artillery is different from being on the front lines with the infantry. But when you're with the artillery, you're also a target because they want to take out your artillery. Did you guys deal with incoming artillery shells or tree bursts or anything?
Sure. They tried to knock us out, and we're trying to knock their artillery out. And they had wonderful armaments. Hitler did something for them. He really had good weapons. Their tanks were far superior to ours.
Can you give us an example of when their artillery or tank fire was coming towards you? And how close that was and how you had to deal with it?
Their 88s were continuously harassing us. They were hunting for us, so we kept moving. We were right in with the infantry. I mean, people seem to feel that the artillery's way in the rear. Well, no, you exploit your range and you move as close to the front as you can so that you can penetrate deep within them. Hit them before they get organized to attack. Yeah. Break up their formations before.
Did you have to deal with losing friends over there? Losing guys that you knew or had become close to?
Most of the friends that I lost were, I'd say, mostly their own fault. Not following procedure, being where they weren't supposed to be. Not because they were there on a defensive measure. They went up there without authority to be there. They were sightseers, or most of those people. Of course, some of them were legitimate casualties, but a lot of them were self-inflicted because they were there where they weren't supposed to be.
What would you say was the hardest thing to deal with, the hardest thing that you had to survive or endure?
I don't really know. I wasn't in a fight for combat for survival. I managed the computations of the firing data to launch our projectiles, and that was what I did all day long and sometimes all night long.
And when I asked you about the Bulge and how cold it was, you said it was cold but not as bad as Korea. So,
No. So
give me a snapshot of what you did in Korea and what you had to endure there.
In Korea, it was real cold, and we didn't have the equipment. It seemed to have been leftovers. The Jeeps had all the floorboards out of them, and we used shell cratings to put the floorboards down because everything was rotten. That equipment wasn't coming back. It was going to stay in Korea. So we weren't equipped like we were when we were in Germany.
But your duties were similar?
Very much. I wasn't in fire direction in Korea. I was kind of a surveyor. I plotted out the and surveyed in our front lines, picked out where the enemy was, surveyed in the 38th parallel so that when we left there, we knew where North Korea was going to start and where South Korea started. That was my job in Korea.
You know, and you stayed in through the Cold War and through the Vietnam War. What were you doing for those years?
Because of my age, I didn't have to go to Vietnam, but I trained troops, reservists, and at Fort Irwin and Fort Lewis.
And you mentioned that you had the chance a couple years ago to go to Washington, D.C. with Central Coast Honor Flight out of San Luis Obispo. And when you go there, you see the World War II Memorial that honors 406,000 Americans who died. And then you go to the Korean War Veterans Memorial, and more than 50,000 died there, and so many are still missing. And then you go to the Vietnam Wall, where there's the names of 58,000 men and probably some guys that you trained. What was that whole experience to go to those three spots on that trip? What was that like for you?
I appreciated the fact that somebody thought about a lot of us guys who fought in these wars and never got a chance to see Arlington, to see all the graves there that are back as far as Civil War, you know. So it was something that I never thought I'd ever see.
Was there one moment or one spot on that trip that meant the most to you?
I don't think I had any preference at all. It was all very interesting. And say, well, this is what we fought for.
And who went with you on that trip?
I took my number two son.
Well, I'm just imagining, and I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but I'm thinking while you're at that National World War II Memorial and you're looking at that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died, who didn't come home from the war like you did, and you're standing there with your number two son who wouldn't have been born if you were one of those stars. Was it emotional for you at the World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes, it was. It was. In fact, as we had a police escort, they just swept the traffic off both sides of the road, and they just opened up, and we went barreling down the highway. Everything was right on time.
That must have made you feel pretty important.
Yes, it did. It made me feel like somebody had put an effort to try and make our trip enjoyable and paramount importance.
Well, if there's anything else that you want to say, I want you to feel free to do so, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you would say as you look back after 35 years in the Army and now 97 years old that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm proud that I got to serve my country.
Why do you fly that American flag so high in front of your house here in Creston?
Well, after I got out of the service, I went to work for the university at Santa Barbara, UCSB. I was on the Chancellor's Council. I only put 10 years of service at UCSB. But when I retired after 10 years, they gave me that flag. That flag flew for the Olympic Games, that flagpole. And so they gave me that flag as a going away retirement deal. And so I had to hire a special truck to haul that flagpole up here, and I put it out there in my front yard. Now I have Jehovah's Witnesses come by and they want me to take the flag down. I said, I'm not taking it down. I said, it's my country. I said, I'm a Hispanic. I said, but I was born in this country. And my parents were born in this country. So I said, it's my flag. I don't have any other.
And he'll keep flying it high. I've got a picture of it for you at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That is Tom Hidalgo. What a remarkable journey he's been on for the last 97 years. That's our program for today. Thanks for spending the hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.